Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind. Later on in this hour, we'll be delving into the issue of gun violence in the Bay Area with Griffin Dix, who has spent decades advocating for safer firearms after his son was tragically killed by a gun, and with Regan Cunningham, whose organization, California Partnership for Safe Communities, works to help cities reduce gun violence and improve public safety. And then we'll talk with Amy Good and Isabella Celadon from Environmental Traveling Companions about their organization's work pioneering accessible outdoor adventure for people with a variety of abilities and backgrounds. But first, we're excited to sit down with Michelle Jeffers, who serves as Chief of Community Programs and Partnerships at the San Francisco Public Library. She's going to give us some summer reading recommendations and fill us in on some of the many activities happening at libraries across the city this summer. So welcome to State of the Bay, Michelle.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here and talk about the library.
Well, we're excited to have you on and learn more about what's happening at the library. And before we get into specific book recommendations, I wanted to first talk about the whole notion of having a summer reading list. And of course, since smartphones became ubiquitous, the number of people who read regularly has unfortunately declined, at least reading books, I should say. And given this trend, how is the library now encouraging people to put down their phones and actually open up a book?
Well, I think that books just open your mind to so many different ideas. But the best thing is that you can also read your books on your phone or on your Kindle. I mean, the library has it all set up. You can listen to books. All of that reading counts for summer reading. We're happy to just have you open a book in whatever format works for you.
All right. So you're going with technology rather than trying to fight it.
Exactly.
Just encouraging people to read books through a different medium. I like it. So people need to get out their notepads and pens as we go through some recommendations here. So let's get started with books for kids. What read aloud books should parents of young children check out this summer in your estimation?
Sure. Well, one that I'm really excited about, and it's kind of our summer theme book, is called Yenaby's Drive to School by Sandy Santamaria. And she's a local author. And this book is really great as a read aloud. I've heard her read it aloud to families. And it's based on really, it's a fictional tale, but it's based on her own true story of crossing the Tijuana border every day to go to school in the United States with her little sister, and how the family prepares to get up early every morning, get some food from vendors at the border, and cross the border to go to school. It's just a really beautiful story.
It sounds amazing and wonderful to have a Bay Area author featured. What about suggestions for maybe older kids, middle readers?
Yeah, so kind of that third through fifth, sixth grade. I like When the Beat Was Born, DJ Kool Herc and the Creation of Hip Hop. It tells the true story of Clive Campbell, also known as DJ Kool Herc, who went to a party in the Bronx in 1973 in the summer and started spinning records and using the gaps between records to make his own music with it. And that's how really created a new kind of musical culture. So that's a beautiful book.
Now, that topic seems like it'd be very on point for middle readers. And let's go with the last young demographic here. What would you recommend for high schoolers or young adults?
There's a couple that I really like. I love Ellen O's The Colliding Worlds of Mina Lee. This is dating myself, but it's inspired by the 80s music video hit Take on Me by A-ha. Anyway, it's a Korean-American girl who gets sucked into the world of the comic books she draws, and she has to find a way out and fight off a villainous corporation in the process. So that's a really fun one.
That's a great music video as well.
Yeah.
Yes, please continue.
I was going to say, I'm also excited about Dashka Slater, also a local author. Her new book is Accountable, the True Story of a Racist Social Media Account and the Teenagers Whose Lives It Changed. It's not a light read, but it's really important. And it really, as we were talking about, asks, you know, where does accountability end for online speech that can harm people?
Very, very timely and topical for young adults, high schoolers. So I want to ask you about adults. But before I do that, I mean, you've already given us a whole bunch of good recommendations for kids. How do you get your list of books to recommend? Are you surveying the library staff for nominations? Are you just kind of going through the stacks yourself to find out what grabs you? I'm curious how you pull your own list together.
Well, we have a great collections department that is just so on point to buying books. We all follow like the reviews and the book recommendations and other sites. And we really curate with what our audience wants to read. But what I pulled next for you is like, what are the most popular books based on how long the holds lists are? I'm probably not supposed to tell this. I should be like, shh, but that's a very librarian thing, but I'm going to tell you anyway.
All right. So we've got some data-driven recommendations, yeah. And that's some pretty powerful data. How many people are clamoring to get a hold of the library book? All right. So let's talk then about adults. What's on your list for the best beach reads, or maybe just here in San Francisco books you could read curled up on a couch when the fog rolls in and maybe you can't go to the beach? What are your top recommendations?
Oh, yeah. There's one I love that I just finished called Ilium by Leah Carpenter. It's kind of a spy espionage novel, very transporting. It's like John le Carré plus a woman dealing with grief. I don't know. It's kind of a weird mashup, but it's about a woman who gets sucked into espionage when her partner dies and she has to befriend the target of an assassination. It's kind of global assassination idea. Very crazy. I also loved Molto by Cindy Fozzie. She's a writer in Sacramento, and she's written this kind of Raymond Chandler-esque novel that's told by a Filipino bounty hunter who is searching for illegal immigrants. Really kind of a beautifully done story, very timely.
Great. Well, again, love having the Northern California authors featured here, and these topics sound pretty fascinating. So I want to also ask about those who maybe don't really enjoy reading fiction as much, or just maybe more drawn to nonfiction books. Are there any nonfiction you can recommend?
Yeah, well, I mean, again, I probably shouldn't say this, but the city librarian, Michael Lambert, I know what he's reading and loving right now. He's reading Eric Larson's The Demon of Unrest, which is about Lincoln and the pivotal 5 months between his election and the start of the Civil War. Eric Larson is a huge bestseller, so people are really excited about that. And then another nonfiction book that I loved, another local author, Kara Swisher's Burn Book. It's very much a catty tell-all about the tech gods around us in the Bay Area who, you know, their personalities, and they very much have empires that sometimes are built on paper with no moral compass underneath.
All right. We're talking to Michelle Jeffers, who serves as Chief of Community Programs and Partnerships at the San Francisco Public Library. So, Michelle, you've given us some great books here that you have read, but what about books that you haven't read but are on your to-do list? What are some of the ones that are coming up for you?
Yeah, I'm dying to get my hands on James by Percival Everett. It's got a very long hold list right now, but it's, of course, retelling the adventures of Huckleberry Finn from the enslaved Jim's point of view. It's supposed to be just hilariously funny, but also harrowing, too. And so I really like books that bring in humor but are serious, too. Another one is All Fours by Miranda July. It's one woman's quest for a new kind of freedom in the world. It's very popular. And Elmer Toll's Table for Two. People loved Lincoln Highway and A Gentleman in Moscow, and now he's turned his attention to a series of 6 short stories. And that short stories are such a great read over the summer.
I hope people have their pens and paper out and have been able to take some notes here. And, of course, it could be digital note-taking tools as well. Now, we're here in the Bay Area, of course, and you've already mentioned a number of local authors. Any other local authors that you want to highlight?
I loved Manjula Martin's The Last Fire Season. She's a local author from Northern California. It's a beautifully written nonfiction book about the fires that have decimated, you know, Northern California, Sonoma County and above. And it's just an ode to the natural beauty of this world and how we're in danger of losing it.
Well, for people who haven't spent a lot of time at the libraries in San Francisco and really throughout the Bay Area, they may not realize just the amount of programming that you offer, particularly in San Francisco, just apart from books. Can you give us just a quick overview of what that programming looks like, even beyond books at the library?
Yeah, well, right now, because it's June, we're celebrating Pride Month. So we have a ton of great Pride-related programs. The Bookmobile will be in the Pride Parade if you come out in San Francisco. But we have like Pride Poetry with Kim Shuck's Poem Jam celebrating sinister wisdom. We have poet Teresa Rodriguez also bringing her beautiful poetry to life. We have some book clubs. The Eureka Valley branch is having a good whodunit, spend an hour with the mystery novel Lavender House, a Pride-related mystery novel. And then we have a zine fest, too, with Zine Thing, which is a monthly zine-making meetup produced by Zine Fest and in partnership with the Hormel LGBTQIA Center at the library. So get to tell your truth, tell your story through a zine.
And are there any special exhibits that our listeners could check out this summer at the San Francisco Public Library?
Thanks for asking. There is an amazing exhibit right now at the main library in the Jewett Gallery. It's called Ralph Chessay, A San Francisco Century, and it's an exhibit about this beloved artist and Renaissance man who worked in many disciplines. He was an actor. He has a mural at Coit Tower. He was a puppeteer, a creator, a writer, a painter, and he created the Brother Buzz television show, which was this very long-running children's puppet show that ran throughout the 50s and 60s. And so we have so many beautiful pieces, original pieces of his artwork. Many of his puppets are on display. We have videos of him putting on puppet shows. It's just really a very special exhibit of rare work of this kind of forgotten artist of the Bay Area.
And I also understand that the library has organized a series to give people a space to discuss death and dying. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, we do have for summer, we're just celebrating death and dying in a way, just really demystifying it. We've been having a series of death cafes, as well as sort of how to plan for your own death and, you know, set your families with all the things they would need to carry on after you're gone. We've done this in the years past, and they've been very popular. We know people are really itching for that kind of program.
And we know we're in an era right now of budget cuts, at least at the state level. And library, of course, is such a crucial service. And I think you being on this show now and talking about all the great exhibits and programs and books is such a testament to that. But how is the funding situation for the San Francisco Public Library doing? And is there anything you would hope that listeners could do to support our libraries?
I think the best way to support our libraries is to visit them. Don't just spend your time on your phone. Again, come in, check out a book, show that you're using your library. We've been very lucky in that last year, the voters of San Francisco did approve a funding measure for the San Francisco Public Library. So we're really solidly set for a number of years going forward. But you've got to use your library and show how important it is in your life for us to keep going.
All right. Well, you heard your instructions. Get out to the San Francisco Public Library. A lot to check out there. And if you didn't get all those book recommendations, we'll see if we can maybe at least put some of them on our website at the State of the Bay page. But Michelle Jeffers, Chief of Community Programs and Partnerships at the San Francisco Public Library, thank you so much for coming on State of the Bay and sharing all these great recommendations.
Thank you.
And coming up next on State of the Bay, we'll be talking with two guests who have been working to reduce gun violence in the Bay Area. That's right after the break, so stay with us.
This week on The Arts, guest host Sheho Latswalo talks with guest conductor Christopher Moulds about the upcoming San Francisco opera performances of Handel's comic opera Partenope. You'll hear about Johnny Lonely's Unhappy Hour, jazz and improv comedy at the Lost Church in San Francisco, and Damian D. Minor talks with the great Mario Van Peebles in town for the San Francisco Black Film Festival. Join us on The Arts, Wednesday afternoon at 4.
On the Emergence Magazine Listening Hour, we explore the threads connecting ecology, culture, and spirituality. In our next episode, I'm joined in conversation with writer and technologist James Bridle, who questions our fundamental assumptions about intelligence.
And so I think we're still awaiting a real ecology of technology, a way of thinking, building, making, that actually starts to acknowledge the fact that technology is as connected as anything else to the world around it.
Join us Mondays at 7 p.m. on KALW.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind. We want you to be part of this next conversation. We're going to be talking about the toll that gun violence takes on our lives and our communities and what's being done to address that here in the Bay Area. Do you have a story to tell about how gun violence affected your life? What are your thoughts on the best ways to keep our communities safe from gun-related deaths and injuries? Give us a call. We're at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also find us on social media if you want to leave a comment there, or you can email us with any questions or comments at stateofthebay@kalw.org. So California has some of the strongest gun laws in the country, but even so, according to the Gun Violence Archive, 1,385 people were killed and 2,744 were injured by guns in our state last year. A devastating mass shooting in Half Moon Bay just last January was another stark reminder that gun violence can strike very close to home. In fact, a report released last summer showed that the Bay Area experienced the second highest number of gun-related deaths in the state over the eight-year period from 2014 to 2022. And a New York Times report released in March showed that nearly three-quarters of Oakland residents live near the scene of a recent fatal shooting. So tonight we'll be sitting down with two guests to discuss ways to reduce this devastating violence. Griffin Dix is someone who didn't expect to become an advocate for gun safety, but when his son died after being shot, he was propelled to take action. He sued the company that made the gun, which killed his son, and he made connections with other families of gun victims, ultimately leading him to become a gun safety activist. He told the story in a book published last year called Who Killed Kenzo? The Loss of a Son and the Ongoing Battle for Gun Safety. We're so grateful to have Griffin on here with us tonight. So welcome to State of the Bay, Griffin.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
And we're also pleased to be joined by Regan Cunningham, who serves as co-director of California Partnership for Safe Communities, or CPSC. CPSC works with a number of cities in our region to help them understand the root causes of gun violence and devise strategies to reduce gun violence and improve public safety. Welcome, Regan.
Thank you so much for having me this evening.
So, Griffin, thank you again for joining us and just for being willing to talk about your tragic and devastating loss. Can you explain what happened to your son, Kenzo, and why you felt it was important to tell his story?
Yes, my son Kenzo was killed back in 1994 in an unintentional shooting when he was visiting the home of a friend of his. The boy, without telling Kenzo, went and got his father's gun that the father kept loaded and unlocked next to his bed. He brought it back to the room where Kenzo was, and he thought he had unloaded the gun, and he pulled the trigger. And there was a bullet still in the chamber of the semi-automatic handgun. And that killed Kenzo. And then we were devastated when we realized that. And, of course, the boy, his good friend, was devastated as well. And then I gradually began to learn about all the things that had caused Kenzo's death, including the unsafe storage of the gun and the way the gun was deceptively marketed as a good means of protection. And so that it turns out this was not only about unintentional gun deaths, but also the, you know, unsafely stored guns and also caused many gun homicides and gun suicides, mass shootings, school shootings, and other kinds of gun deaths. So I realized gradually that I wanted to, that other people should know about this, and I began wanting to write a book. And then we sued Beretta USA, the maker of the gun, arguing that it should have had a prominent chamber-loaded indicator. Ultimately, we lost that case after three trials taking 10 years. We came very close to winning. But I joined a California coalition that included the Giffords Law Center people and the Brady chapters all around California and Everytown people and Moms Demand Action activists and other people. And they were wonderful leaders, Ahmed, and many victims of gun violence who'd lost children. And we passed well over 100 laws that helped reduce rates of gun death. You know, in the laws we passed helped save about 950 to 1,000 lives per year in the U.S. because by making handguns safer, by requiring safety features on handguns sold in California, the gun industry complied because California is such a big market. And so they started selling those safer guns in the rest of the country as well. And well,
Griffin, I want to get into all these details of what you've done. First of all, I just want to say I'm sorry for the loss and this tragedy. And it's been amazing to hear just a little bit right now of what you've done with that tragedy to try to ensure that it doesn't happen to anyone else. And I want to get into all the different laws and different ways that we can try to prevent tragedies like this from happening. But I just want to give a chance for Regan to jump in here. Regan, I know your organization also has a focus on reducing gun violence in the Bay Area, but you're coming at it from a different angle. Can you tell us why California Partnership for Safe Communities was founded and what it hopes to achieve?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, I also too want to express my condolences, Mr. Dix, for the loss of your son, Kenzo. The California Partnership for Safe Communities was founded in 2011. And one of the things that we do, it's actually a lot of things that we do, but our main focus is working from what we call a triple bottom line. And so what that means is we work in cities and communities to help them reduce gun violence in the near term. And so, again, this isn't a 15-year plan. It's how do we help you begin to see reductions in the first year or two and help cities to sustain that. The other thing is we want to reduce recidivism in the cities and communities that we work in. And why that's important is that so often media and other outlets and law enforcement has focused on success as being based upon the number of people taken to jail, the number of guns recovered. But if people are still dying in our communities, we don't really see that as success. So we want to reduce the recidivism rate and not take more people to jail. And the last thing we try to do is help build community police trust. We know that those relationships are strained, and so we're intentional when we work in cities with law enforcement, with community members, with survivors of gun violence, and with community-based organizations. So again, our organization has been founded really to reduce gun violence at the city level, and more specifically, we focus on community gun violence. Not so much with suicides or domestic violence, but the unfortunate day-to-day violence gun violence that we see in many communities throughout the Bay Area and in California.
And Regan, I know your organization recently released a Bay Area regional gun violence analysis. What did you find to be the main factors contributing to gun violence here in the Bay Area?
Yeah, thanks for asking about that. So interestingly enough, because we work in all these different cities throughout the Bay Area, we would be in meetings and the same names would come up around individuals who were engaged in gun violence. And so specifically, we have historically worked in Stockton and Oakland and San Francisco had begun to have a few meetings in Antioch. And so with some very generous support from Kaiser Permanente, we started actually looking into this to try to figure out, is there a regional connection? And one of the things that we found through our research was that I think that regionalization of gun violence is definitely a real thing. And gentrification has dispersed high-risk individuals and networks across the Bay Area. And what we mean by that is if we just look at Oakland and San Francisco, a lot of folks in San Francisco have been priced out of the market, and so they moved to Oakland. And specifically with Oakland and San Francisco, we've seen, I'd say in the past 2 or 3 years, where individuals who were actually San Francisco residents were killed by other folks from San Francisco, but in Oakland. And again, that just goes back to we have folks who, you know, again, priced out of the market in San Francisco and have moved to Oakland. And a similar thing has happened in Oakland, where people have been priced out of Oakland and have moved to what used to be outlying suburbs like Antioch. And so, again, when we looked at, we actually did several interviews with service providers in Oakland, in San Francisco, in Antioch, as well as in Stockton, as well as interview law enforcement. And they have seen the same thing where historically, you know, folks would just focus on one city, their specific city. But what we've seen now is individuals who used to be active, for example, in Oakland or in Stockton are now active in other cities throughout the region. So one of the challenges has been gentrification. The other thing is we've seen a rise in freeway shootings. And again, in our interviews, with the qualitative data, the interviews that we've been able to conduct, at times, freeways have been used intentionally by individuals and networks engaged in violent conflicts. And then I'd say the third thing is that when we talk about intervention, because there hasn't been formal intervention networks across these cities, many of the cities that I've named, it has become a significant challenge. And so what I mean by that is that, for example, if an individual is engaged or at high risk of being engaged as a victim or perpetrator of gun violence in, let's say, City A, they may be relocated to City B, but there's usually no communication between City A and B. And so the individual is in City B without really any services and supports. And again, just because those communication mechanisms have not been formalized. Mm-hmm.
So it's truly a regional challenge, and I definitely commend that report to listeners to check out. And if you're just tuning in, this is State of the Bay on local public radio, 91.7 KALW, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm Ethan Elkind, and we're discussing ways to address gun violence. We're joined by author and gun safety advocate Griffin Dix, who just published the book Who Killed Kenzo? The Loss of a Son and the Ongoing Battle for Gun Safety, and Regan Cunningham, co-director of California Partnership for Safe Communities. Do you have a story to tell about how gun violence has affected your life? What are your thoughts on the best ways to keep our communities safe from gun-related deaths and injuries? You can give us a call. We're at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also find us on social media if you want to leave a comment there, or email us with any questions or comments at stateofthebay@kalw.org. Well, Griffin, you were just discussing when we last heard from you about some of the state policies that California has passed to try to reduce gun violence. Which of these do you think have had the biggest impact?
Well, the kind of interventions that Regan is specifically talking about, like ceasefire programs that call in the call-ins where people who are at risk of actually committing gun violence are called in and told this has to stop and we can help you get a job if you need one, but this has to stop, are very effective. And one of the things the coalition I was a part of did was to fund local violence intervention programs like that. Those are extremely helpful. It was a disaster that during the Trump presidency, the mishandling of COVID, so many people bought guns, you know, after the murder of Floyd by the police and the, you know, debates back and forth. And so many people bringing guns into their home actually increased the gun death rate in California, but much more so in the rest of the country because we had stronger gun laws still. We do have good safe storage laws and we're working on some better ones. But I think it helps a lot even to have these safety standards for handguns sold in California. And there's a whole long series of good laws that we've passed in California. Far too many to go into here. But,
yeah. Well, I just have an email in from Edgar in San Francisco who writes, after the shooting in Half Moon Bay last year, I read that states with stricter gun laws have fewer shootings, but that obviously didn't stop that tragedy. It seems not a month goes by without a mass shooting being in the news, even here in California. What do your guests think can be done about this? Regan, what's your response? What has worked in California, teeing off what Griffin was just talking about? And what else can be done given that a lot of this issue boils down to federal policies?
Yeah, so I would say a few things. It's also just kind of really looking at the reason or the motives behind these mass shootings. One of the things I do appreciate from some of our younger activists in the community of when we think about mass shootings, thinking about what happened in Half Moon Bay, but also thinking about what's happening in our communities every day. On the same day that the horrific shooting happened in Half Moon Bay, there was a mass shooting actually in Oakland where seven people were injured. So I think we need to kind of expand what we were talking about in mass shootings. But in each of those instances, the motivations were different. And so I think the appropriate thing is looking at what is the right type of intervention for the types of shootings that we're talking about. So in my line of work, what we look at, again, is what we call community violence intervention. So looking at shootings that may be individuals who are at high risk, who might be involved in gangs and groups and retaliatory shootings. And so there's a lot of very successful initiatives actually in California that have helped to reduce that type of violence. Mr. Dix mentioned the ceasefire initiative that had been, you know, very successful in Oakland for many years. Los Angeles had a program called the Gang Grid Program, Gang Reduction Youth Development Program. Richmond has the ONS, our Office of Neighborhood Safety. So there's a lot of different models that are out there. One of the things that our organization recently did is that the federal government often recommends best practices in reducing gun violence to cities and to practitioners. One of the things that we've seen after doing this work for a very long time is that you have these models, but most of the times when cities adopt these models, they aren't successful, regardless of what the model is. And so we actually did some research that was funded by Pew Charitable Trust to look into why is that? If these are considered best practices or promising practices or evidence-informed practices, why do they not work in most cities most of the time? And through our research, we were able to look at seven cities actually across the U.S. to find out what are the things that really matter in terms of reducing gun violence. And not saying that models don't. I think models are extremely helpful and instructive. But what helps cities actually go from having a model to reduce community gun violence, as we're talking about, to actually seeing actual reductions in gun violence? And so we have this paper on our website, but it's six things. One is we call political governance. It's so in a strong mayor form of government, the mayor basically being a champion, a lead on saying gun violence reduction is my top priority. Having a data-informed analysis of who is at highest risk and what is driving gun violence in your community. Is it domestic violence? Is it community gun violence? What is it? And who are those who are at highest risk? Having a cross-sector collaboration on a shared strategy. So what is the shared strategy and who are the partners at the table and what role do they play in that shared strategy? The other thing is effective operational management. Great to name the strategy. Great to have people at the table. We've all been at meetings where there's lots of people at the table. But how is this actually going to work? So who is in charge of running this strategy, ensuring that there's accountability, ensuring that there's fidelity? And the last two things that are very important is effective violence reduction infrastructure. So we talk about an effective CVI ecosystem. So, for example, if we know that the individuals who are at the highest risk of gun violence in a particular city, the average age is 29, they've had 12 prior felony convictions, they may be associated or have ties to gangs or groups, then we need service providers who can effectively work with that population. The other thing is a police department that's committed to reducing gun violence and building legitimacy in communities where gun violence is the highest. And lastly, we have the sustainability in planning and institutionalization. Many times when cities see reductions in gun violence, they, you know, wave the white flag. We've, you know, quote unquote, won. We're done with this and go back to the things that they've always done. And what tends to happen is that gun violence rates will increase.
Mm-hmm. Griffin, I wanted to ask you about safe storage, safe gun storage, since that was such a critical factor in the tragic death of your son. What kind of advancements have we made on that issue in California?
We've made a great deal of advancement since my son was killed. There are requirements that guns in homes need to be safely stored, and there are consequences if a child gets a gun and uses it. And there's a bill right now in California, SB 53, that would even strengthen the safe storage laws more. And it's a very worthwhile bill, deserves our support.
It's good to
also mention, just to go.
Sure. No, please proceed.
Reagan was saying that extreme risk protection laws, otherwise known as red flag laws, where it's someone who's clearly a risk to himself or others, family members or law enforcement can petition a judge that a gun should be temporarily removed from that person. And that can be extremely preventive and to prevent mass shootings or gun suicides.
And we did get a listener email on this. Amy in Oakland wrote in to ask that the Supreme Court is considering a case that challenges the constitutionality of California's law barring people with a domestic violence restraining order from possessing firearms. And Griffin, I think you might have been referencing that policy, but this listener writes, I'm interested to hear your guest's view on how effective these are at stopping gun violence and what they think the impact will be if they're found to be unconstitutional. So Griffin, maybe see if you want to answer that, and Reagan would be interested in your take as well.
It's very dangerous. The case before the Supreme Court is one where a person guilty of domestic violence is trying to be able to get his gun rights back and be able to own a gun. That's not a good idea. And it's not, you know, there are limits to the Second Amendment. In the Heller Supreme Court decision clearly states that there are limits to the Second Amendment, mm-hmm. right? I hope the Supreme Court decides that the right way, but we have a pretty horrendous Supreme Court at the moment. We'll see what happens.
Well, Reagan, do you want to weigh in on this? Any thoughts about what the ramifications might be, or what to maybe expect from the Supreme Court on this issue?
I too share the same concerns that Mr. Dick shared. I do think that I would love to be hopeful with the Supreme Court, but I think their track record has not really been in favor of protecting our communities in a lot of ways. And so I am very deeply concerned about the Supreme Court's decision. Again, just going back to how dangerous those types of situations are, especially again with domestic violence, you're often in the same residence, or if you're not in the same residence, the person who you may have restraining order against knows your location. And so, again, very concerning. And so we'll see what the Supreme Court does.
And I wanted to ask you also about this issue of ghost guns, where people find these new ways to manufacture firearms, including 3D printing. They can just assemble them in their homes. What have you been seeing on this front?
So it's actually interesting. We saw more of this, let's say, maybe about 2021, 2022, and specifically in two of the Bay Area cities that we were working and are working in now. There was concern about ghost guns in terms of the number of recovered guns that police departments were seeing, where there was no serial number, et cetera. Essentially, they were ghost guns. And so we saw during the pandemic year, the early part of the pandemic years, I should say, We did see an increase in ghost guns in Bay Area cities. Again, these are guns that people are able to make at home, or basically there's not guns that are bought. You can buy parts to make these guns off of the internet and they can be sent to your home. And so we did see a significant increase in violence in some of our Bay Area cities during the first couple of years of the pandemic. And through some research that was done with the ATF and some researchers at University of Pennsylvania, we did see that in several of those incidents, those guns were utilized. Since that time, we haven't seen as much in terms of an increase in ghost guns, but I can say for at least two of the Bay Area cities, there was a significant increase in ghost guns, again, 2021, 2022, and that is supported by data and research from the ATF.
Well, we just have just a minute or so left, so I want to just ask each of you a final question here. And Griffin, first final question for you is just what laws or other initiatives are you hoping to see get passed that you think could really make a difference when it comes to reducing gun violence?
I think SB 53, this improvement in the safe storage laws, will be a very useful bill. And it'll make families safer. That's one.
And anything else just briefly you want to mention?
There's more requirements for, law enforcement to not resell parts and of guns they've recovered, mm-hmm. so that they have to destroy the entire gun. That's a very important.
Yeah, rather than letting it get back out on the market.
Gun dealers to mm-hmm. Be monitored very closely and get that reporting as well.
And Reagan, just final question to you. What would you like to see happen, just policy-wise, initiative-wise, going forward? Just about 30 seconds here.
Sure, absolutely. I think one of the great things is the federal government is realizing that community violence is worthy of investment. And so I think that's a great opportunity for many cities and communities across the U.S. and for community-based organizations to apply for funding. Along with that funding, my hope is that community-based organizations and cities are able to not just look at models that help to reduce gun violence. I think that's important, and we should look at those evidence and promising practices, but also have a better understanding of what are the key capacities that it takes to implement those models successfully so that more lives can be saved.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. I just want to thank you both so much for joining us. Such an important topic. That's gun safety advocate Griffin Dix, author of Who Killed Kenzo, The Loss of a Son and the Ongoing Battle for Gun Safety, and co-director of the California Partnership for Safe Communities, Reagan Cunningham. Thank you both so much for coming on State of the Bay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And coming up after the break, we'll hear our guest host, Fred Pitts, interview the leaders of an organization that works to make outdoor adventures accessible to all. We'll be right back.
Get ready to get your laugh on for Pride. Hi, I'm Janae Darden, and you're invited to the Sights and Sounds Pride Comedy Show, featuring comedians Rhea Kapoor, Marcus Williams, Frida Sierra, and country artist Cindy Emsch. That's the Sights and Sounds Pride Comedy Show on Tuesday, June 25th. The venue is 220 Montgomery in San Francisco. Doors open at 6. Show starts at 7. This is for adults only. Visit KALW.org for free tickets.
On the Emergence Magazine Listening Hour, we explore the threads connecting ecology, culture, and spirituality. In our next episode, I'm joined in conversation with writer and technologist James Bridle, who questions our fundamental assumptions about intelligence.
And so I think we're still awaiting a real ecology of technology, a way of thinking, building, making, that actually starts to acknowledge the fact that technology is as connected as anything else to the world around it.
Join us Mondays at 7 p.m. on KALW.
Since 1972, Environmental Traveling Companions, or ETC, has pioneered accessible outdoor adventure for people with a variety of abilities. By using a highly trained corps of volunteer guides, ETC keeps costs down in order to make rafting in Gold Country, kayaking on the SF Bay, and cross-country skiing possible for all. Today we have Executive Director Amy Good and Youth Program Director Issa Celadon. I'm Fred Pitts, your host, and Amy, Issa, welcome to State of the Bay.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Fred. Hi.
Hi, nice to meet both of you. So how is ETC a travel companion?
Well, our main mission is to make the outdoors accessible to all. Our youth leadership program caters to inner city youth from under-resourced backgrounds, and we do summertime expeditions. But all of these trips, the river rafting, the kayaking, the youth trips, the skiing, it's all about bringing folks into adventure and making them comfortable and making them feel safe and welcome. And so that's where the traveling companion part is that we have volunteers and a highly skilled staff that hold hands, bring them the right equipment, give them confidence, help them feel capable and excited to have these adventures that they might not otherwise have.
Wow. I guess my first question is, how do you find and train the volunteers?
That is a big and constant ongoing job. So any and all outreach we can do. We have a lot of partners that we work with, but a lot of word of mouth, honestly, because ETC has been around for over 50 years. And it's amazing the people that want to bring friends in. And the volunteers become friends for life. We now have new volunteers that are second and third generation ETCers. And it just keeps growing. It's a big community and a family that just keeps expanding.
Do you all provide training for your volunteers, or are there people who have experience with the various services that you provide?
We have people that have never even been in a boat come and volunteer. I mean, it's literally people of all different backgrounds. Some are retired, some are college students, all ages, from all over the bay, really. And then, you know, rafting as well. We have a pretty broad footprint, and we do trips out into Malls Bay and San Francisco Bay too. Very extensive hands-on training. We require that everyone has at least CPR first aid. They get actual boat on water training, as well as part of the whole ETC lens in which we do our work as well.
Interesting. Issa, you're in charge of the youth program. The volunteers you have are the same ones for the other program as well, or is there a separate kind of training for the people who work with your program?
That's a great question. So the youth lead program is a little bit different from the other ETC programs in the sense that we do hire instructors who are seasoned outdoor professionals who come on and support the whole expeditions. When we go sea kayaking, we do bring in sea kayak volunteers from the ETC sea kayak program. And when we go rafting, we bring in raft guides from the raft program who are volunteer guides. But we do hire some instructors for the youth lead program specifically.
Okay. How did you both get involved with this?
When I heard about this job, it was kind of the perfect blend of my stewardship background and passion for working with people and being on the bay, and the environmental piece too, that's baked into everything we do. We do a lot of environmental education and, you know, watershed awareness and things like that. So that was super exciting and appealing to me.
And Issa, how about you?
This is my third year with ETC. I'd been a raft guide before and wanted to try out sea kayaking. I was a third grade classroom teacher, and I was like, I want to do something fun with my summer. And in August, I was like, I want to keep doing this outdoor education, learning with folks on the water, in the bay, having those really impactful experiences with people from all backgrounds and of all abilities. So I transitioned into the youth lead program, which made a lot of sense for me.
You both sound very passionate and very excited about this program. So what kind of adaptive devices and strategies do you have to employ to make these trips worthwhile for the participants?
So on the ground, when you're setting up the sea kayaks for folks with their different abilities with their mobility, we have different kinds of padding that can fit into the sea kayaks and make it more comfortable so that folks can sit upright while paddling. We have paddle attachments where you can use the paddle with just one hand. So it clips onto the top of the sea kayak and you just kind of row it with one hand and have a great time on the water. For folks who are wheelchair users, we have things called Mobi mats that are like these big, thick mats that roll out onto the sand. So we can push people in their wheelchairs, or folks can wheel themselves out towards the kayak to, you know, give them the closest access possible to those kayaks. We are trained to transfer folks if they need it from their wheelchair into the sea kayak. So those are some of the very practical things we do on sea kayak trips. Like the bigger lens when I'm thinking about curriculum for the youth lead program and making it accessible to folks who might be afraid of going in mm-hmm. the water or might never have been in outdoor situations. I try to build in as much trauma sensitive learning, like supports for my instructors so that they can be attentive to the needs of our students mm-hmm. who come from sometimes really difficult backgrounds, sometimes backgrounds with no experience in the outdoors.
And Amy, are the adaptations similar for rafting? I'm sure there are other ones for the cross-country skiing part as well.
Yeah, I would say we just try to make people as comfortable as we can and as safe as we can, right? And rafting is a little bit different because it is more of an adventure sport. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times people are passengers instead of paddlers. So we have special setups for that and have got assistant guides on either side of them, kind of making sure that they're staying in the boat. We don't want anyone ever attached to any boat, and just make sure the number one thing in all of our safety talks that we say, if you should find yourself in the water, the first thing that you do is smile because we got you. So that's where we have really highly trained guides and volunteers that are ready for any and all kinds of excitement in the outdoors. I mean, that's what it's all about.
Well, you mentioned excitement. Do things go wrong?
We really pride ourselves safety number one, and we really, ETC throughout, you know, its history has set the bar in actually industry standards. We are one of the first rafting companies on the American River to start mandating helmets for all participants. You know, with sea kayaking, like I said, every guide is well trained in all sorts of rescues, even adaptive rescues, mm-hmm. right? Because like Issa was saying, sometimes we might have someone with vision impairment, somebody with mobility impairment. There's extra challenges to getting those people back in the boat. And if they're cold and really surprised, the first thing you want to do is to help them feel comfortable and safe, that mm-hmm. we're going to get you back in the boat and we're going to get you dry. We're going to get you warm. Having confidence in our crew that, you know, we're not freaking, it helps the person that might find themselves in the water mm-hmm. that they can still have a positive experience.
Okay. Well, is there a way to measure impact, I guess, either with participants and or with the volunteer guides?
This is one of my favorite things. The Youth Lead Program, we have different stages of involvement for students who feel really passionate and interested mm-hmm. in being in the outdoors. So students can participate in a summer course that's either 2 or 3 weeks long. And then afterwards, they're invited to apply for a school year fellowship during school to continue growing as leaders and in the outdoors. So the Youth Lead Program is unique in that we get to see folks at different stages in their growth and development. And so the reason why I'm the most interested in this is just because I get to see it, and it just, oh my gosh, it just like ignites such a fire for me to see folks who were so nervous about like whether they would be able to enjoy this experience if it was right for them. And now, like a few years later, I see them going back to be a field intern for the second time. So I think that's one way to measure how many folks keep coming back for different levels of involvement.
One final question for each of you. What's your favorite memory or moment?
Oh, that's a great mm-hmm. question.
At the graduation, there was a youth on the trip who had developed a playlist. And so each day of the trip, he had a different song that was thematic to what the day was. And some of them were bummer songs, and some of them were like champion songs. And he shared this playlist at the graduation. And to see this youth that had, you know, really pushed his boundaries in a lot of ways, that was just such an amazing moment. You could just feel the highs and lows through music.
That sounds amazing. Issa, what about you?
I remember my first summer with ETC when I was a sea kayak intern. I was working on a skills day for students, so they were like brand new to paddling. One student in particular was feeling very, very nervous, and I chatted with them and was like, do you still want to do this? And they were like, yes, I do. I'm just feeling really scared. And I saw them blossom throughout just that one day. And it was so, so cool to see them just really enjoying being on the water despite having felt so scared in the beginning, and watching them kind of grow.
Well, I would love to keep asking you all questions, but I'm afraid we're out of time. So I really want to thank both of you for coming on the show today. If anybody out there listening today is interested in participating in these programs, either at one of their trips or as a volunteer, you can go to their website, etctrips.org. That's etctrips.org. I once again want to thank the Executive Director, Amy Good, and Youth Program Director, Issa Celadon, for coming on the show today. Thanks to you both. It was a great time.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
That was guest host Fred Pitts, and that's State of the Bay this week. We hope you'll join us next Monday at 6 for a discussion about the viability of office-to-residential conversion in downtown San Francisco. And remember to subscribe to the State of the Bay podcast wherever you listen so you never miss an episode. For more information about this and other State of the Bay shows, you can visit our page on KALW.org. If you have any questions or comments about anything you heard tonight, let us know. You can email us anytime at stateofthebay@KALW.org. Tonight's show was produced by Chris Nooney and Heather Hughes. It was engineered by David Kwan, and D Minor was our board operator. A replay of today's Your Call is coming up next. I'm Ethan Elkind. Good night, and thanks for listening.